This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الَّذِينَ صَبَرُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favour after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Ukraine is calling on the civilian population in Slavyansk to urgently evacuate as Russian forces close in on the city. South Korea's president orders his troops to promptly retaliate against neighboring North if it engages in any provocative behavior. Also ahead, a 20-year-old Palestinian man becomes the latest victim of Israeli gunfire in the West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. It's our top story for this half-hour in Ukraine. Officials are calling on civilians in the eastern city of Slavyansk to urgently evacuate as Russian troops continue to advance to secure the entire Donbass region. Slavyansk has become a new battleground just days after Russian troops took control of the neighboring Luhansk province. Local officials say Russian forces have been shelling the city chaotically over the past couple of days, mostly targeting civilian areas. The governor of Donetsk says the city is now within the range of Russian multiple rocket launchers. In an attack on Tuesday, at least two people were killed and seven others injured, some of them seriously. Russia consistently denies it targets civilians. Donetsk province is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. Together, Luhansk and Donetsk form the Donbass region, which has witnessed deadly conflict between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian groups in the past. Our correspondent Johnny Miller, who's based in Donetsk, joined us earlier with the latest on the ongoing battle between Russian and Ukrainian forces in eastern Donbass region. Let's take a listen.
Well, in terms of the attacks on Donetsk, it's very clear that it's the Ukrainian army shelling Donetsk, where I am. Last week, a German channel put out a story saying it was Russia that was bombing Donetsk. They quickly had to retract that story. Interestingly, I saw yesterday the Daily Mirror newspaper in the UK absurdly reported that Russia again was attacking Donetsk, which is simply not the case. I think many of these journalists simply don't understand the complexities of this war. Many other mainstream outlets have got it correct, and that it is Ukraine shelling Donetsk. It's been happening for 3 days. There hasn't been much this morning, but the last 3 days, heavy shelling for most of the day. A 10-year-old girl was killed yesterday. Some shocking footage from her death. And every day, the last few days, there's been terror created around the city. The Ukrainians clearly trying to target areas. I went to civilian areas. I went to a market yesterday. They target markets. They're more likely for people to be there and to damage the civilian infrastructure in order to terrorize the people here and to hopefully to stop the people's support of the pro-Russian forces here. And that's been going on intermittently for the last 8 years, but the people seem very resilient in supporting the pro-Russian forces. So there's a hope here. Some people I spoke to yesterday when I interviewed them, when they heard that I was British, they became very angry at me. Why? Because they know that NATO countries are supplying the Ukrainian army with these weapons. For example, the Scottish government has been forced by the British government to give £60 million in military aid to Ukraine. It's very important for people in NATO countries to recognize the simple fact that Ukraine uses some of their taxpayers' money to target and to kill civilians here in Donetsk, including, as I say, a 10-year-old girl. Yesterday, last week, I went to the funeral of a 6-year-old girl killed by that Ukrainian shelling. And I think that's one of the reasons why you have this information war, and indeed
right.
almost no Western journalists have come to this part of Ukraine, because it's just a very uncomfortable fact of this war that so much taxpayers' money is being spent to target and to kill civilians here in Donetsk.
Elsewhere, NATO says it has no plan to set up bases in Sweden and Finland once they complete the membership process. The alliance's deputy secretary general says NATO is not going to send troops to the two countries as they are capable of defending themselves. The remarks came shortly after NATO members signed the accession protocol for the two countries. Now it's up to parliaments in all 30 member states to ratify membership of Stockholm and Helsinki. The two Nordic states requested to join NATO after Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in February. Russia has repeatedly expressed its opposition to NATO's expansion. President Vladimir Putin warned last week that Moscow will respond symmetrically, if NATO deploys troops or infrastructure to Sweden and Finland. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is in fresh crisis after two of his cabinet ministers stepped down over his leadership. Health Secretary Sajid Javid resigned from his position. He said he could no longer fulfill his duties in good conscience, as he did not believe in the Prime Minister's ability to govern in the national interest. Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak was next to quit from his job, saying the government should be run, quote, properly, competently, and seriously. Opposition Labour leader Keir Starmer said Johnson's government is collapsing. The resignations come as Johnson faces backlash over keeping a former Conservative Party whip in his post, despite being accused of sexual misconduct. The Prime Minister survived a no-confidence vote last month after 41% of his party colleagues wanted to oust him. Earlier, we were joined by our London correspondent, Robert Carter, to bring us up to speed on the new crisis in Boris Johnson's government.
And there's no doubt about it. This news is absolutely devastating for the embattled Prime Minister. This concept of, is he the right man for the job? Will he still be in his position going forward for much longer? This has plagued him for months now, even before the no confidence vote against him last month, which took place, where 148 of his own party members, his own MPs, voted against him in that motion. However, these are very senior resignations, very important key members of his cabinet, including the Treasury chief, who has resigned during a cost of living crisis. How Boris Johnson is going to navigate that at this time, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly the question of whether he can survive this latest round of resignations will have to be seen. There are actually pundits in British media circles now that are actually basically throwing in the towel for the Prime Minister, suggesting that he should probably consider going soon. I even saw on, I think it was Talk TV, there was a pundit close to the Conservative Party who suggested that he'd be surprised to see the Prime Minister last longer than, say, this weekend. So over the next coming days, we're going to have to keep a close eye on that news, because there could be some breaking news in the near horizon.
The South Korean president warns of stern retaliation in case of any provocative behavior by North Korea. Yoon Suk-yeol issued the warning during a meeting with top military commanders amid reports that Pyongyang is preparing a new nuclear test. Yoon, who took office in May, has also called for boosting capabilities to deter North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. The North is in a long-running dispute with South Korea and Japan, as well as the United States. Pyongyang says its nuclear program is for self-defense in the face of U.S.-led threats. Washington and its allies want the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and have slapped a wave of sanctions on North Korea. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith says the South Korean warning followed the arrival of U.S. stealth fighter jets in the country as a newly elected president is seeking to boost ties with Washington.
Have a change in government here. Yoon Suk-yeol is the new president. He's a conservative, and he's vowed to take a hard line with North Korea. During the campaign, you know, he just was sworn in May. During the campaign for the election, he suggested that South Korea bring in more terminal high-altitude area defense. That's THAAD. That's an American anti-ballistic missile system. He's also vowed to strengthen the alliance between South Korea and the U.S. Just this week, the U.S. flew in something like six F-35 Joint Strike Fighters to take part in Air Force exercises with the South Korean military. Yoon has promised to take, again, a hard line with North Korea. He visited Spain for a NATO summit, the first South Korean president to visit a NATO summit to again, strengthen other countries' support for his hard line with North Korea.
One more Palestinian falls victim to Israeli gunfire as the regime's forces intensify crackdowns in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 20-year-old Rafiq Riyad Ghanam was shot during an Israeli raid on a village south of the city of Jenin. The victim was standing in front of his home when targeted and then detained along with another youth. Ghanam later succumbed to his injuries. Israeli forces carry out deadly raids in the occupied territories on almost a daily basis. The flashpoint city of Jenin has become a center of resistance in the wake of repeated attacks by Israeli settlers and forces there. Mona Kandil is with us now from Ramallah to tell us more about the recent shooting that took place outside the city of Jenin. Mona?
Well, lately, the Israeli military has been conducting nearly, let's say, daily raids in the occupied West Bank areas and cities, mainly in Jenin and the villages around it. What happened this morning is that Israeli forces raided Jenin and a number of villages. There's a village called Jaba near Jenin where the Israeli soldiers wanted to arrest Palestinians. They opened fire towards Palestinian citizens, wounding a number of them and arresting them. One of those who were arrested after he was shot by the Israeli forces was Rafiq Ghanam, 20 years old, from the village of Jaba. According to eyewitnesses, Rafiq Ghanam was only standing outside his home, at the door of his home, when he was wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces. Later, Israeli military declared that Rafiq Ghanam succumbed to his injuries. We have to mention that the Israeli military declared that one of the main reasons for raiding Jenin is to arrest a well-known wanted Palestinian fighter. His name is Amid Arsan. He was a former Palestinian prisoner, and when he was released by the Israeli forces, he was wanted, and the Israeli military was also chasing him. They arrested him this morning, Amid Arsan, 24 years old, from Jenin. Not only this, what happened this morning, today we are speaking about over 40 Palestinians were detained, not only in Jenin, 30 of them were arrested by the Israeli forces in Silwad. And we have to say that Silwad, in the last few weeks, we have been witnessing the clashes and more, let's say, anti-Israel operations being carried out by Palestinians also originally from Silwad. So the main aim for the Israeli military today is to continue raiding the areas homeland of Palestinians who carried out anti-Israel operations or are engaged in the different forms of resistance, like Jenin and Silwat today.
All right, thanks a lot. Mona Kandil joining us from Ramallah. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister has asked for the immediate release of an Iranian citizen jailed in Sweden over alleged rights abuses. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment at a phone call with his Swedish counterpart, Ann Lind, late Tuesday. He noted that the long-standing relations between the two countries should not be affected by propaganda and baseless measures of a criminal terrorist group. Amir Abdollahian also said Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri is in Sweden's jail over groundless accusations leveled against him by anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist group, the MKO. The Swedish foreign minister, for her part, said her country's government and judiciary would not be swayed by the MKO's anti-Iran propaganda. Hamid Nouri is accused of rights violations against MKO members. In the 1980s, Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for him. Iran says Nouri's trial is a political show. Iran's foreign minister says an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal is possible only based on mutual understanding and interests of all sides. Hossein Amir Abdollahian once again voiced Iran's readiness to negotiate a strong and durable agreement. He criticized the U.S. for its inability to make a decision during the negotiations. Amir Abdollahian said if the U.S. wants a deal, it must stop insisting on its unilateral demands. His remarks came after a Tuesday phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Borrell tweeted that the parties to the JCPOA revival talks must make decisions now if they want an agreement. The talks were stalled for more than 3 months over excessive demands put forth by the U.S. The Qatari foreign minister is scheduled to arrive in Tehran in the coming hours for talks with Iranian officials. According to Iran's foreign ministry, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim al-Thani is set to hold talks with his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdollahian. They will discuss bilateral relations as well as regional and international issues. The visit comes a week after Doha hosted the EU-mediated indirect talks between Tehran and Washington over the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Thousands more people flee their homes as rain-triggered floods continue to wreak havoc in Australia's New South Wales. Emergency services have issued more than 100 evacuation orders since torrential rains hit the country's east coast over the weekend. Floodwaters have already submerged communities, roads, and bridges in Australia's largest city, Sydney. Authorities have issued fresh alerts north of the city, citing the danger of rain-swollen rivers. They've ordered more than 80,000 people to evacuate. This, as the meteorology department says, the weather system is expected to move off later this week. More than 20 people have lost their lives since the flooding started in March. The government says the disaster in urban areas has pushed insurance claims to over 2,700 in Sydney alone. Sudanese protesters reject a claim by the country's coup leader that he's making way for civilian rule, calling it a, quote, transparent maneuver. Sudan's main civilian bloc, the Forces for Freedom of Change, has called for more protests, dismissing Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's move as a giant ruse. On Monday, Burhan vowed to make room for civilian groups to form a new transitional government. The announcement came 8 months after the coup ousted civilians tasked with forming an interim administration, sparking widespread international condemnations. Sudanese have been demanding the return of civilian rule, and hundreds of anti-coup demonstrators are continuing their sit-ins in capital Khartoum. The African nation is in the grip of unrest since the ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir back in 2019 and a subsequent military coup. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
and a supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
The latest report from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research showed that the Brazilian Amazon has lost 1,450 square miles of jungle since the start of 2022. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Activist Fear, Tipping Point of No Return as Fires in Amazon Rainforest Surge. Stay tuned for more. The Brazilian government has published a report showing that more than 2,500 fire hotspots were recorded in the Amazon rainforest last month, the highest number for June since 2007, one of the worst years ever for the critical ecosystem. The latest report from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research showed that the Brazilian Amazon has lost 1,450 square miles of jungle since the start of 2022. Greenpeace Brazil said in response to the alarming figures that the far-right Bolsonaro government's systematic rampage against basic environmental protections is responsible for the surge in rainforest fires and overall deforestation, which have helped transform parts of the Amazon, long known as a key carbon sink, into sources of planet-warming greenhouse gas. Agribusiness is hitting new records for forest destruction as the dry season arrives in the Amazon, said Christian Mazzetti, spokesperson for Greenpeace Brazil, adding, illegal burnings and deforestation have accelerated over the last 3 years as a direct result of the Brazilian government's anti-environmental agenda that encourages the destruction of the forest. Mazzetti added, if this trend does not change, we will approach the tipping point of no return in which the Amazon could fail as a rainforest. Brazilian academics have warned in recent months that a Bolsonaro victory in the October presidential election would mean total demise for the Brazilian Amazon. Recent polling shows that Bolsonaro is trailing leftist former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who has vowed to pursue net zero deforestation if elected. If Bolsonaro remains in the power of presidency, it's hopeless in terms of the environment, Marcio Astorini, executive secretary of the Sao Paulo-based Climate Observatory, told HuffPost in April, a record-shattering month of Amazon deforestation. Astorini said there will be more deforestation. The Amazon will fast forward to its collapse point. Environmental groups have voiced dismay at the Biden administration's failure to confront Bolsonaro on the international stage over his government's assault on the Amazon. The U.S. is Brazil's second-largest trading partner. Last month, during the U.S.-hosted Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles, President Biden went as far as to praise Bolsonaro for trying to protect the Amazon. In addition to being divorced from reality, Biden's statement is remarkably tone-deaf. Maria Laura Canio and Luciana Teles Chavez of Human Rights Watch wrote on the final day of the summit where the two leaders met for the first time, Biden has shamefully squandered the opportunity to leverage his meeting with Bolsonaro to support the courageous defenders of the Amazon. These defenders are putting their lives on the line to protect the world's largest rainforest and a vital bulwark against climate change. They continued. Biden should correct this mistake and press Bolsonaro to reverse his damaging policies, urging Bolsonaro to get Brazil back on track in fighting deforestation and protecting forest defenders from violence. Diana Ruiz, the head of forests at Greenpeace USA, said in a statement that, up to now, the Biden administration has only legitimized the Brazilian government's anti-indigenous and anti-environmental agenda. Ruiz added, the U.S. has a responsibility to act and stop making deals with President Bolsonaro, who continues to wage an assault against indigenous peoples and environmental defenders.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ukraine and Western governments.
Part 2.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky. The gold, its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera, himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitali Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR. Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies that helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side presented more favorably. They work on things like, how do you get traction? How do you get things to go viral? How do you then use that to generate support for your cause?
And support was generated.
Mustafa Nayem.
Mustafa Nayem, a founder of one of Ukraine's new media outlets,
Доброго дня, доброї ночі, точніше.
Громадське TV, knew very well how to make something go viral. It was his notorious Facebook post on November 21st, 2013, that brought the first crowds to Maidan. If you don't read the newspaper, you are uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you are misinformed. To deliver your message efficiently enough in the modern world with so many different technologies and means of communications, you must embrace them all. As the disturbing events of Euromaidan started on November 21st, 2013, three new TV channels went on the air and suddenly became stunningly popular in Ukraine. Spilno TV, November 21st. Romatske TV, November 22nd. And Espresso TV, November 24th, directly from opposition protest. These channels went viral, supporting the protests and encouraging more and more people to come to Maidan. November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan, and one of its most reported and mysterious events.
After riot police attacked peaceful protesters with clubs.
Happened in the early morning hours. The eyewitnesses that were there said that the police did use truncheons.
Coincidentally, Sergei Lovochkin is a close associate to many U.S. politicians. The security service of Ukraine had evidence that on that night, Lovochkin was in contact with opposition leader Yatsenyuk, where they discussed the clearing of Maidan on the pretext of installing the annual Christmas tree. News media reported that the riot police cruelly attacked the students peacefully sleeping in their tents, but scenes from the event seemed to tell a different story. It appears that the protesters were waiting for the police. Additionally, there were dozens of journalists and cameramen from all the new public TV news outlets prepared to cover the events. And most ominously, a group of well-trained young men arrived to Maidan almost simultaneously with the riot police. They infiltrated the crowd and began provocations with insults, stones, and torches.
The riot sector in Ukraine represents a part of the Ukrainian population that has often favored fairly extreme right-wing positions. They had militias that came especially during the Maidan protests. There were groups that were being shipped into Kiev, where they would provide the muscle, in effect, for the demonstrations. So the demonstrations went from being relatively peaceful political protests to being increasingly violent.
The first step in any detective work is to establish a motive. It is now said that Sergei Lovochkin is held in high esteem by his powerful U.S. friends. Outraged by what was reported in the news, the Ukrainian people came out in force on the next day to vent their anger with the police actions. As veiled and masked as the color revolutions can be, an attentive viewer can see subtle patterns and similarities revealing their true nature. To make crowds act as one obedient group, they have to be united at the unconscious level. The masterminds of color revolutions know this well and have perfected the art. Symbolism is one of the most powerful tools to achieve this end. Revolutionary political organizations with surprisingly similar names and even more similar logos have appeared time and again, almost as omens marking the countries that would be hit by the colored plague next. They are often described as being aware and active when they're actually trained and radical. They are the ones who take the first shot, literal and metaphorical, to transform the peaceful protests into full-blown coup d'etats. Their fingerprints can be found everywhere on the map of the color revolutions. Using all the experience of past generations, simple but effective tools like catchy sing-alongs and chanting are employed. Well known for exciting the crowd and creating a group identity, they depersonalize individuals and make them easier to manipulate. Incidentally, one such organization, Hromadske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
We will be back here on this square to celebrate with you a Ukraine that stands with Europe and stands with the United States.
Well, members of Congress were visiting Ukraine during that period, most famously Congressman John McCain. So some of the people who were challenging their government, their elected government at that point, were being told by a senior U.S. official, a person who ran for president and a top official in the U.S. Congress, that the U.S. was with them.
I'm Senator John McCain, and it's always a pleasure to be back in Ukraine.
Senator McCain was, in a sense, giving the people in the Maidan a feeling that they had the backing of the most powerful country on earth.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
In early February of 2014, as the Maidan crisis was getting more violent, there was a phone call that was intercepted. It was a call between the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine. I'm not saying the whole U.S. government feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe. The neocons are very smart people, and they've been at this for a long time. They came in around the issue of propaganda. They studied how to create hot buttons for the American people. They had this experience when they were getting the American people to get excited about Central America back in the 1980s. And they've been applying those same strategies ever since. They remain very dedicated to achieving their goals. They still want to get rid of certain governments. They wanted a regime change in Syria, for instance, regime change in Iran. They're very skilled at this, and they have a lot of allies now inside the news media, inside the government, and that means that they can do a lot to control the narrative of any story.
I think in America these days, we have somehow told ourselves that there are a lot of ways of dealing with these problems other than hard power. Vladimir Putin cares about hard power.
The neoconservatives can now demonize a leader of a country. That sells with the American people. So you don't just sort of argue a policy. You attack the leader. So the neoconservatives became very skilled at picking out leaders, finding their ugly traits, and then highlighting them. Yanukovych, you might say, was a rather clunky political leader, but you make him into a devil. He's totally corrupt, and he's evil, and he wants to kill people in the Maidan, these wonderful white-hatted demonstrators. So you've got a black hat versus white hat. You keep repeating that basic scenario, and it works with the American people.
You've got to realize what Vladimir Putin is. He's an old KGB colonel that wants to restore the Russian Empire.
You make them into demons, and the American people find that the way they can understand the world. Once that happens, it's very difficult for journalists or anyone else to say, you know, hold it, that guy, he's got more of a gray hat than a white hat or a black hat. And if you say that, you suddenly are you're a Yanukovych apologist or you're a Putin apologist, and then the attacks come on to the person saying it, the journalist, the academic, or whoever.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013, was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city. On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine. This has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs. On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
Et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later. And here again, we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who is at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. Each of you here should stay strong in spirit, he said, because we're not going anywhere.
The Limelight.
This month, the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, COI, on the occupied Palestinian territories found that the ongoing Israeli regime occupation of Palestine is the root cause of the decades-long conflict in the region. But as the probe gets underway, the Israel Lobby's flagship organization, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, is actively attempting to extinguish it. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How APAC is Leading Efforts to Dismantle the UN Inquiry on Palestine. Here's the story. This month, the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, COI, on the occupied Palestinian territories found that the ongoing Israeli regime occupation of Palestine is the root cause of decades-long conflict in the region. But as the probe gets underway, the Israel Lobby's flagship organization, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, is actively attempting to extinguish it. In response to the inquiry led by the UN Human Rights Council, UNHRC, members of Congress have initiated legislation to abolish the investigation in both the House and the Senate. On June 14th, Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Nevada, Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen introduced the COI Elimination Act S-4389. The bill is similar but not identical to H.R. 7223, also called the COI Elimination Act, introduced by Representatives Gregory Stoop, Vincent Gonzalez, and Joe Wilson in March. Both bills seek to abolish the UN inquiry as well as other groups in order to combat systematic anti-Israel bias at the United Nations Human Rights Council and other international fora. The legislation also calls for restricting U.S. funding to the UNHRC by 25% of the amount budgeted. While the Senate bill only has 3 co-sponsors currently, the House version has nearly 70 signatories made up of mostly Republican representatives. The UN inquiry came as a result of the Israeli regime attacks on Gaza and occupied East Al-Quds in May 2021, with the purpose of investigating human rights abuses that occurred during that period. The United States, the Zionist regime, and 19 other countries have sharply condemned the inquiry following the release of its first report. U.S. Ambassador to UNHRC Michelle Taylor said during the 50th session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva, as the UN inquiry's first report was being debated, "We believe the nature of COI established last May is further demonstration of long-standing disproportionate attention given to Israel in the Council and must stop." The U.S. State Department has also rebuked the U.N. inquiry, its spokesperson Ned Price remarking, "We firmly oppose the open-ended and vaguely defined nature of the U.N. Human Rights Council's Commission of Inquiry on the situation in Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, which represents a one-sided, biased approach that does nothing to advance the prospects for peace," unquote. The UNHCR did not respond to press queries on the congressional bills, instead reiterating the COI's goals and that all member states must abide by its actions. However, a UNHCR spokesperson did tell Mint Press News that the mandate of the Commission of Inquiry was supported by a majority of member states of the Council, and the allocation of a budget was then approved by the General Assembly. All members of the Human Rights Council are expected to fully cooperate with its decisions, as reaffirmed in General Assembly Resolution 50-251 of 2005. According to Jewish Insider, AIPAC has spent this month lobbying on Capitol Hill for more members of Congress to support the COI Elimination Act as part of its first in-person National Council meeting in Washington, D.C. since the start of the pandemic. Their efforts appear to have succeeded as needed.